You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome into the Locked On Nets podcast, third podcast episode I'm doing today, so that's exciting. And for the first time in a long time, I'm back with the Joshua Bass. Josh, you had a snow day today. How'd that go?
I mean, I was working from home, but
Come on. You weren't working. You were making snow angels. You were playing with your buddies.
No, that's I wish I was, but unfortunately, duty calls. And I love when you said first time in a long time. It reminds me when people call into like a Mike Francesa show.
Long time listener, first time calling.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the Tonuses of the world that call in every day.
Yeah, I think I tried to call into a WFAN show once.
Yeah.
And I wanted to troll Francesa by saying, I forget what year it was, that Anthony Davis shouldn't even go in the top 10.
Yeah.
And we went and drafted, and then I was on hold for like 5 minutes. I said, this is enough.
I got an interview for an internship there one time, but they called me like, it was like a summer internship, and they called me like 3 months after I applied, and it was already in the middle of the summer, so I thought they were prank calling me, so I didn't take the interview seriously, and then I didn't get a call back after that.
Yeah, sounds about right.
Okay.
It's pretty in line with everything I know about you.
It's a character. Speaking of incompetency, the Nets, a good transition, right? The Nets blew a 23-point lead tonight to the mostly incompetent Charlotte Hornets. And it was really, it was the third quarter. It felt like the game flipped. Though now that I'm looking at the box score, actually, the Hornets only outscored the Nets by 7 in the third, and it was really the fourth where things got bad, but they gave up Dwight Howard and 19, but they gave up 19 points to Dwight Howard in the third quarter, and he finished with 32 points and 30 rebounds, and that's how I'd sum up their downfall in this one.
Yeah, I mean, they were making Dwight Howard look like Moses Malone, down to having a 6'6" center in Quincy Acey guarding him
for most of the game.
Yeah, and just no adjustments on the part of Kenny Atkinson, because the Nets weren't scoring as is with his brilliant five-out system. So I don't know why he wasn't trying like a Mozgov or Okafor, just because they are large human beings. And Okafor did a good job against Embiid a few days ago. Embiid and Howard, obviously similar strength and body type. So I would have given it a shot, but Atkinson said, no, we have to keep rolling with Allen and AC. That's why we end up giving up 32 and 30 to Dwight.
Yeah, and if like the 30 rebounds weren't indicative enough of how dominant he was, Dwight shot 21 free throws in this game. So that's not so great. And then the whole thing
he didn't even play that well. Like, he honestly could have had 45 points, given how close he caught the ball to the basket every time.
Yeah, no, my favorite part about this game, like honestly, like this game like summed up Dwight Howard's career in my mind, because he was obviously like, I know you make the point that he didn't play as well as he could, but he was still like clearly like all in all like dominant. Like, you don't just get 32 points and 30 rebounds, but despite that, my biggest takeaway from this game from him was him just repeatedly trying to take the ball up the court and play point guard. So that to me is like the Dwight Howard experience. Like, he's like amazing, but like you remember like the stupid stuff more than him being amazing.
Yeah, honestly, his handle isn't that bad.
No, it's pretty smooth.
Yeah, like he can get it up to half court, and then it's like, okay, look for a pass. But he's got a few highlights this year where he's taking it coast to coast and had some nice crossovers. But yeah, Obviously not what you want from your offense.
No, not necessarily. All right, so let's we can rewind back to the beginning of this one and work our way forward. The Nets, not really like a slow start, but it felt like Charlotte just like was like dead, kind of like they just looked like totally unmotivated. And I felt like the Nets could have jumped on them even earlier than they did. But then around the middle of the second quarter, they start on a 17-3 run that eventually turned into a 28-7 run, and everything was clicking for them. And I love the play between Caris LeVert and Jared Allen. They had like a couple nice back and forth. So Spencer Dinwiddie was shooting the ball better than he had been. D'Angelo Russell, in my mind, had a terrible game, but statistically looked pretty good. It was just like a really balanced effort in the first half, and I really did like the way they were playing. And they and it was interesting, because I guess you weren't with me, and you probably didn't listen to the podcast in the 10 hours since I put it up, but in the Grizzlies game, I was kind of talking about like how I was, even though they won, I was disappointed with how they played, because it was essentially a G League team that they were going against. And like this one, like I thought in the first half, like they really upped the ante a little bit, and it just kind of seemed like they were to win two games in a row for the first time in like 2 months. And I felt pretty good about that.
Well, no, They did win two games in a row because
they
beat the Mavericks before.
Oh,
yeah.
Three games in a row for the first time all season.
But listen, the Nets are 23-49 for a reason. They're not particularly well coached. They don't have much talent. I mean, Charlotte's probably looking at these guys saying, hey, this is a G League roster that we're playing. These guys think that Quincy Acey is like a legitimate NBA player, and they're throwing him out there in crunch time.
He was good in the first half.
He was okay. I mean, he hit threes well, but he's still a complete liability on defense, and that's not necessarily his fault because Atkinson's putting him in disadvantageous situations. But he did hit threes well, and I guess provided some spacing. But when your guys aren't using driving lanes to really score anyway, there's no point in having him in there.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And I just got like repeatedly frustrated. Like I just don't get how you can keep him out there in crunch time because. And this was an issue earlier in the year, and obviously when the Nets had Dante Cunningham active, like this no longer became an issue. Or if they just got more creative with their lineups around Jared Allen, it wouldn't necessarily be an issue, or maybe played Rondé at the four spot. But what you kept seeing is he'd be out there in crunch time, and I think the logic of it is for Atkinson is like obviously everything tightens up in the final 5-6 minutes of an NBA game, and like the lanes get a little thinner and everyone starts playing with a higher level of intensity on defense. So let me throw out this 3-point shooter at the 4 or 5 spot, and with that my guards are actually going to have room to make a play at the basket because they can't leave Quincy Acey. But that doesn't actually work in practice if Acey is totally unwilling to shoot in those situations. And we saw that in the closing minutes. Like there were a couple of times where he had open threes and he'd be totally passive, and it was like he didn't want to be the reason the Nets lost the game. And I think that really kind of stifled their crunch time offense. My other issue in crunch time was I thought Spencer Dinwiddie should have been out there ahead of D'Angelo Russell. And I know Dinwiddie hasn't been great like over the last 10 to 12 games and has really regressed in a lot of ways, but he was playing well this particular game. And I don't know. I think Russell was just so I'm trying to think of the right word, like lethargic kind of over the closing minutes. Like he just wasn't making anything happen. Yeah. No, that's fair. But particularly over the closing, he just like wasn't even like at least like earlier in the season and like at points over the last 10 games or so, like he's at least like been aggressive and like tried to make stuff happen in the final minutes, but that just hasn't been the case lately. And like in this game, like I think part of the reason the Hornets came back is like he like seemed to like fall asleep essentially. And I mean Dinwiddie, whatever you want to say about his play recently, that's just never, he's never that guy. He's always gonna go for it. So I would have liked to have seen him out there.
Well, I kind of disagree on that because I don't think Russell played particularly well, and there were a few times when he had a mismatch against Kaminsky and he really couldn't create any separation, and that's a terrible sign because even guys like LeVert and Dinwiddie, who aren't Russell Westbrook by any imagination, are really able to drive by these slower bigs, and Russell can't do that whatsoever. But Dinwiddie was playing pretty terribly, I thought, towards the end of the third quarter, really not getting into a rhythm on offense as well. Starting every possession, really getting into the offense with 5 seconds left on the shot clock. I thought he really did a pretty bad job in terms of running the ship, and that's when Charlotte was able to cut the lead from like 14 to 8 or 9 early in the fourth quarter. So his stats look pretty good in terms of that he shot the ball well, but I don't think he did a great job in terms of getting the Nets into their sets as efficiently as possible.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I'm not going to say that's outrageous. Like, I don't think either one of them had, like, an exceptional game. It's just, like, if both are playing poorly, like, Dinwiddie's, like, the guy I'm going to go with. I'm going to be like, all right, go rev him up. Were there any other positives? The Nets held Kemba Walker to 6 for 25 shooting, but that felt like it was more of, like, Kemba Walker just having an off night.
Well, Crabb did a good job. I thought he was really getting around screens well. But, yeah, they held Kemba Walker to 6 of 25 shooting. Batum didn't play, and they still lost to Charlotte. I mean, that just can't happen. Kenny Atkinson just doesn't adjust at all, and I'm really getting frustrated. I mean, you're 23-49. I said this before, but why are you sticking so rigidly to your five-out system when it's not leading to any results? I mean, they don't have talent right now. The process isn't looking anything special. It just, you have to be able to make adjustments. And even something where they were down by 4 in the last 10 seconds, and they clearly needed a 3, Brad Stevens is not going to have Quincy Acey out on the floor instead of a guy like a Joe Harris or a Spencer Dinwiddie. There's no reason to have someone there just to set screens if they're a below-average three-point shooter. You need your 5 best offensive players on the court at that possession. He just doesn't do these things that optimize the team's success.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there, and I'm kind of. It was like a situation where like everyone just seemed to shut down. Like that was like the biggest thing for me. Like I just hated that. Like the Nets didn't have any type of killer instinct. Didn't it just feel like at like the beginning of the fourth quarter, there was like a window, like if the Nets hit like two or three more shots, like they could have just ended this game and Charlotte would have given up and like both teams would have put their benches in for the fourth and it would have just been over. And it just felt like the Nets like didn't put their foot down. And I get like a lot of that was strategic and like not having anyone in there that could box out Howard.
Did not win?
No, sure. But like, I mean, like not like intentional, but I mean, like there were strategic issues in that. Like they didn't put in like someone like Mozgov or Okafor to like at least try and get a body on Howard. But I'm just saying even beyond that, just like on the offensive end, it felt like there was like this whole stretch where they could have ended the game. And it felt like the Nets like, they just like stopped playing. And like, it's the same issue we've seen at the start of games. Like I thought it was like it was the same thing against the Grizzlies. Like they had every opportunity to put them away in the fourth quarter and they just totally refused to do it. And that's really what's bothered me more than anything else. Because we've seen, I thought earlier in the season, this Nets team like really did have like, not like a special like killer instinct. Like obviously they were still losing close games, but they were just always competitive and like playing their asses off. And it just feels like that's kind of gone away as the season's gone on, and that's kind of disheartening to me, just watching this team.
Yeah, I know, I do agree with what you're saying. It seemed like even though the lead was slipping away gradually from 20 to 15 to 10 to 7, it's like they didn't realize that they thought the lead was still at 20. They just had no idea that the game was getting closer. And I think it speaks to your point that when they're the underdog, they can kind of be scrappy and play up to the level of their competition. But when they do have a lead, they just don't have the top guy that's really able to kind of put the ducks in a row and say, here, I'm going to carry us to the win.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll finalize our thoughts on this one, maybe talk about some tangential aspects of the game or get into the Nets' upcoming schedule. Welcome back into the Locked On Nets podcast. The Brooklyn Nets falling 111 to 105 to the Charlotte Hornets. Gavin Shaw, Josh Bass, the full squad with you to break it down.
Yeah. When was the last time we did a podcast together?
I thought then we did one last week, I think. And then before that it'd been a while. We've done it's like when a team like sandwiches a win between losing streaks. We've only done one in like the last like 2.5 weeks, so
it's like when One Direction gets back together for like a quick tour.
Yeah. Quick influx of cash, the tour. I'm trying to think of other thoughts I had in this game. I don't know. I can get into some of the tangential stuff that I wrote down. I thought the call of the game, which we haven't done in a while, was Lamb Fires overcooked it when he missed the three. That was pretty good.
When he also said, yeah. He's like, lamb to bacon. That's a lot of meat.
Oh, I missed that. That's pretty good. He did, the game before, he had crab over lamb. I'm hungry. I wanted, and there was like a similar opportunity to this game. And I wanted him to say surf and turf, but he didn't do it. So if we ever get him on the podcast, I'm going to point that out to him as a missed opportunity. And I'm sure he'll take it in stride.
I'm sure he'll love that, yeah.
Yeah, no, definitely.
What was the City Bike thing that you were freaking out about?
Oh, no, they were just, like, they were coming out of commercial, and they just, like, they had, like, a 10-minute, they focused on City Bikes, and, like, Sarah Kustak was like, Bird, you ever ride one of those? And Ian's like, no, I've never really had the need to, because he's a billionaire. And he assumed, but it turns out he's done them in other cities. He's done like city bike type things. So I wonder where that is. I don't know. I just picture him like riding a bike through Italy with like the eaglet in like a basket on in front of the bike. I don't know. Something along those lines. I think that's a possibility. And then I was surprised, like Sarah Kustak was saying she doesn't ride bikes in the city, and they were talking about how dangerous it was. And I'm glad that they like appreciated the danger I put myself in every time I go on a city bike. So respect to the broadcaster. I really do. And like I rarely wear helmets too, because I'm a badass. But no, you should wear helmets. All right, anything else fun? There was one really cool play where Caris LeVert had like a reverse spin move and then like dumped it off to JA, and he had a reverse dunk. That was nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. This game was uninspired. I feel like when the Nets built that 20-point lead, it was just more because of Charlotte's incompetence that they didn't really play particularly well. So just looking back, even on the positive moments, there isn't really a lot to get excited about.
Yeah. No, that's fair. All right. A random question for you that I had from this game. I'm kind of interested in like how like Dwight Howard like finishes off the rest of his career, because I don't know, in my mind he was like essentially like retired last year when he was in Atlanta, and now he's like back and like kind of like on paper having like a very solid season in Charlotte, but obviously like the team sucked, and that's kind of been, I mean, the pattern of like the whole second half of his career, that like his numbers didn't really equate with team success. But like after the game, it was kind of cool seeing like everyone on Charlotte go up to him, and like the story with Dwight, his whole career is that like everyone on his team hates him, and like they seem to like be like genuinely happy for him. And I was like wondering, like, I don't know what his contract situation is, or like maybe he's in Charlotte for a few more years, but like I'm kind of wondering like if there's like a final step on his career, and like if like in like a year or two he's like on like a title contender, and like if he's still relevant. Like I'm kind of interested like how he finishes it up. Is that, I don't know if you got a chance to, but I was like listening to the Low Post with Steve Clifford on it, and like obviously he was with the Magic when Dwight was there, so it was kind of interesting to go back and like reflect on those Magic teams and like a time where Dwight was like legitimately like the second or third best guy in the NBA, and it's fascinating because normally those guys get more fanfare down the stretches of their career, but Dwight was just never really that person. So that was like a long-winded way of asking like how do you think his career finishes up?
I really can't ever picture him fitting in on a contender, because even now he's still, even on a kind of a diminished Charlotte team, he's still demanding his post-ups, and he's not really kind of doing the little things like a pick-and-roll type guy. I mean, if he embraced more of a Clint Capela role, then I'm sure any contender would love to have him, because he's still an absolute freak of an athlete for his size. But, I mean, he's making $23 million next year, and then he's a free agent after that. I think he's kind of going to bounce around in mediocrity the rest of his career, and it's a good point that you mentioned, because he really was such a huge larger-than-life superstar going back to his time in the slam dunk contest, and now it's really he's so irrelevant. Like, no one really talks about him on a daily basis in the NBA stratosphere.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, and like, not that like he was like ever, but it's so funny like how like someone like Carmelo Anthony, who's like obviously like on like a bigger team, but has just had like such a longer lasting impact as a star. And I think like we'd both agree like Dwight at his peak was like quite a bit better than Melo ever was, but like Melo has just had like such a longer relevance, and D-Wade who I would argue D-Wade at his peak was better than Dwight at his peak, but you could make a case that they like made like similar impacts on the NBA.
Vince Carter, I feel like, is still being talked about more.
Yeah,
he's completely just at the twilight of his career.
Yeah,
in Sacramento.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. So it's very interesting how he just kind of like faded out of like the like collective like NBA conscience, but he's still kind of plugging along, and he's still clearly capable of great games on occasion. Another guy who interests me on Charlotte, not to go like too far down this rabbit hole, is Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. Like I'm just kind of surprised, because I just like that when he was coming out of Kentucky, I just thought he was going to be like a really good player, and like obviously like that was kind of contingent on him developing a jump shot, but even if he didn't, I thought he was going to be a guy who just grinded his way to like 18, 20 points a game and was like considered like far and away like the best perimeter defender in the NBA, and he just seems like so irrelevant now. Even in this game, like I heard his name like twice.
I don't really know what to make of him, because he does seem like he has all of the intangibles on paper, but he still doesn't really make an impact. And he still has never found that 16 to 18 foot shot. I mean, his form is slightly better than it used to be. But yeah, I thought he honestly has the potential to be like that Draymond Green type if he ever extended his range to become a credible 3-point shooter, but just doesn't seem like he's improved at all since his rookie season.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. And that's, I don't know, it's kind of disappointing.
I think being on a team that played him exclusively at the four could be a better fit for him, because now he has to deal with obviously a lot of true centers there in Dwight and Hernan Gomez, where they play him, and Kaminsky, and also guys like Marvin Williams and Batum. It's kind of an awkward fit for him being on a team with so many front court players.
Yeah, they have like a lot of guys that play like similar roles to him, and if anything, are like a little bit more versatile to him. But I'd like to see him on a team like surrounded by shooters. Like if he was like a bench guy on like Golden State or Houston, like I wonder. I think he'd be interesting in some playoff series. So I kind of
reach Jay's role in the Nets.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. I'd like to see him end up on another team at some point and see what he can do. All right, those are some random Hornets thoughts. We'll take one more break, come back, talk for 2 or 3 minutes about the Nets' upcoming schedule, and then wrap this one up. Welcome back in to the Locked On Nets podcast. You are listening to Locked On Nets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. The Nets, in their next two games, take on two of the favorites in the Eastern Conference. They travel to Canada to take on the Raptors and then come back home to play Cleveland one final time. According to ESPN, tickets start at $73 for that one. So if you want
to
see...
I'm going to that one.
Oh, yeah. You with Baca, right?
Yeah.
Are you excited? When was... Have you? How many times have you seen LeBron in person in your career?
Once. So I saw him it was either his first season with the Heat or his second season with the Heat, when the Nets were still playing at the Prudential Center. I'd say it was about 85% Heat fans. the Nets were selling like inside out jerseys. So one side it would be like a Brook Lopez, and the other side it would be Kobe or Dwayne Wade.
That's pretty funny.
And it was one of the most embarrassing things I've ever seen. That's having to deal with all these screaming 9-year-old bandwagon fans around me.
Yeah.
Saying how much they love LeBron.
I remember like really disliking like anyone in our high school who was like a Heat fan, and I'd like quiz them and be like, what was the starting lineup for like the 2005 2006 Heat, and like the ones who knew were real, like our guy Sanam knew current friend of the pod, Cam Neely, he knew, but like there was, I'm not gonna name any names, but there was a particular couple in our high school that like claimed to be Heat fans, but like didn't actually like know anything about them outside of the fact.
I don't know who you're talking about. You'll tell me off.
I'll tell you off air. Yeah, they're a dynamic duo for sure. yeah. No, I remember I've seen LeBron I think twice, maybe three times in his Cavs career. I saw him. I went to a game. My first NBA game, first or second NBA game ever, was his rookie year, and I remember being like terrified of Zitrudis Ogauskas because he had the white mask on and he looked like a giant like Silence of the Lambs style like mass murderer. So that was my biggest takeaway. But like I don't know if you like remember, there was like this like NBA book that came out one year, and on the cover they had like a picture of like LeBron doing like his signature like fast break like tomahawk dunk in MSG, and like I'm 90% sure that was the game I was at. So that was like a cool moment if that's not a false memory. And then I saw him in Phoenix his first year back in Cleveland, and the Suns knocked them off in like what was like the peak of that Sun season when they won 48 games, and it was like 132-130, and it was like the peak of Cleveland's dysfunction, and it was like LeBron's first game back, and then right after that they ripped off like a 10-game winning streak, but LeBron dropped like 35 in that game. It was just incredible. So I don't know, I kind of wish I'd seen him just put the money down and be like, I'm gonna see him like once every year in his career, just because it is such a special experience. I'm kind of jealous, Josh, that you're gonna get to go, and like I really hope you enjoy it, because I know our boy KOC mentions it a lot, but like it really is like special, the fact that he's still doing this at 33, averaged a triple double for a whole month, is still probably the best offensive player in basketball, at least like in like a one game setting. I would still consider him that guy. So it's really unique, it's special, it's part of history, like I would say, not just even like a basketball but like a sports, because he's gonna go down as one of like the five or six greatest athletes of all time period. So I want you to appreciate that and enjoy it.
Yeah, we get to see him go head to head against Spencer Dinwiddie and Caris LeVert, so it should be a pretty even.
That'll bring the best out of him, I think. Like he always rises to the challenge. Yeah, that'll be cool. It'd be nice if the Nets beat the Raptors. They've been playing them pretty well all year, and they've lost 11 in a row, so they're kind of due. But I have a feeling after this game, Toronto's going to win by like 20 or 30.
Yeah, don't hold your breath on that.
Okay, that's fair. All right, we can wrap this one up, Josh. Any final notes? Anything? Anything going on in your life?
I love when you put me on the spot for this.
Yeah. You don't have to have something going on, Josh. It can just be. It could be mellow. We don't have to. We don't have to end with a bang.
I feel like you already know offline what's happening in my life.
No, I know, but it's okay, we can act. We can act. Improv.
Wait,
say yes.
We haven't taken that improv class yet.
No, you just got to say yes.
That's why I don't know it yet.
But all right. Okay. We'll wrap this one up for Josh Bass. I'm Gavin Shaw. Thank you for tuning in to Locked On Nets.